Hello, and welcome back to Cruising Through History. Oh, it's nice to be back, isn't it, Scott? Yes,
it is very nice.
Nice. So, I'm Xander again. I'm sitting down with Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we starting the third season from?
I thought we'd talk about the serial killer H.H. Holmes.
H.H. Holmes, isn't he an author? Or wait, what? Go. Okay. Okay. You know what? Scott, go.
Well, okay. If you remember when we had our Jack the Ripper podcast, I did mention him. Mm-hmm. Holmes was made famous, and it's not his real name, and we'll talk about that too. But H.H. Holmes was sort of, I never knew who he was until I read the book The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, which is a really good book about the World's Fair in Chicago in the 1890s. And it's a parallel story that runs because Holmes, it was actually, there was a lot of stories that he was committing murder in this hotel that he had. And then it was built for this specific purpose with trap doors and fake rooms and all this other crazy stuff. And slides that would go into the basement where he could throw a body down. And, you know, he had these gas things that he could open up in the rooms.
Jeez.
And so, but it turns out the funny thing about Holmes, and that wasn't his name. His name was actually Herman Webster Mudgett. He was born in 1861 in New Hampshire. He had attended the University of Michigan Medical School. And it was there that he and a professor allegedly were robbing graves to get cadavers for the medical school, which wasn't an uncommon thing. Mm-hmm. But he also, later when he returned to New Hampshire, he apprenticed with a doctor who practiced human dissection. And so he's kind of learned some of these tricks. And I only mention him in the Jack the Ripper thing because there is a descendant of Holmes. I'll call him Holmes for the sake of this podcast because he had about 15 aliases, so it made it very hard when I was researching this. And because we know a lot about him, whereas we knew nothing about Jack the Ripper, mm-hmm. we know a lot about Mudgett Holmes. I'll get this right. And so it was only in he didn't use the name Holmes until he moved to Chicago like in the 1880s. And he bought a drugstore there and was employed in it. And then he bought a plot of land right across the street in the Inglewood section of Chicago. It's just still there. The building itself isn't, but Inglewood's still there. And right across the street, there was a deserted. So he started to build a building. And it was the first floor had a store. He had started running his own drugstore. Mm-hmm. The second floor was like a rentable apartments. And then when the World's Fair came to town, he said, oh, I have this idea. I'm going to build a third floor on. Where I can have people who are coming to the World's Fair, they can stay here. Mm-hmm. No one, at this time, he wasn't really a murderer yet. He was quite the fraudster because he was an inveterate liar, certainly a sociopath, so that's one thing they can do.
Okay.
So he always claimed that he killed 27 people. But it turns out that half the people he claimed were still alive, so you don't know. People have been trying to untangle this for hundreds of years. Well, not hundreds, but over 100 years because you don't know when he was telling the truth and when he wasn't, when he was kind of bragging.
He just lied for whatever, not just for like a reason, but it was just in him to lie about stuff.
Right. And not only that, but he had three bigamous marriages. Plus he had three mistresses, all of whom he killed. But one author who wrote a book called The True History of the White City Devil, H.H. Holmes, Adam Seltzer, he doesn't describe Holmes as a serial killer per se, because he said Holmes usually killed people he knew, mm-hmm. and he also usually killed them because they were getting in the way of his other plots.
His other plots?
Like his frauds.
Oh.
He had actually met a woman named Annie Williams, and she was from Texas. And she owned like $10,000 worth of property. There was a lot down in Fort Worth, Texas. And so he married her, or maybe they were just I got confused after a while.
Well, when there's so many mistresses.
Exactly. So he said, here's what, why don't you just, you know, sign the deed over to me? So she actually signed it over to one of his aliases, Alexander Brand. Mm-hmm. Well, and lo and behold, she disappears. So Now we have another heir, though, her sister, who came. He said, why don't you have your sister come live with us in Chicago from Texas? I'll take care of her and everything. He was really smooth talker, a fairly handsome man, so he could do some of these things. So her sister, Marie, goes up there, and she disappears. Well, now he's the, well, his alias is the only person holding the deed to that property. So those kind of little things were, and then actually his first mistress was, got involved with him. She worked at his drugstore. And then when her husband found out what was going on, he left. So it was her and her five-year-old daughter. Well, they both disappeared in like 1891. This is really the first case of someone in around him disappearing. And this is why it would later become a problem to try to charge him with things.
So let me get this right. Part of the reason, like, there were dots being connected here is because he had so many different aliases.
Yes.
So it would be like, well, this person went to see that person and they're gone. But when we go there, there's no one by that name.
And he would just lie and say, oh, they went to live with a friend or they said they were leaving. And of course, this is the 1890s. There's really not a real lot of ways to track people down.
Yeah.
And most times you just believe it because that happened all the time. You know, you go stay with an aunt or something in our city or something. And the thing about the World's Fair was that you had a lot of people coming to Chicago anonymously alone. And there were a lot of people that never came back from Chicago. Now, later, everyone would go crazy and attribute everything, every disappearance to Holmes. But there's really never been a lot of proof that even the hotel itself was built for that purpose. And a lot of people would argue that when he built that third floor, he was basically trying to bilk creditors. So he would buy a ton of furniture on credit and then hide it in secret rooms and claim he never received it and he couldn't pay. And they would just skip town and they couldn't find him anywhere.
Yeah. So really, I mean, he's like a businessman, but he's going to go for his business and support it in whatever way possible with no holds barred, which including disappearing people.
And it isn't until after he's caught that we find out all these things. At the time, people didn't just thought he was a businessman and no one really paid too much attention to what was going on. But then in about 1892, when he was building this third floor, he meets a guy named Benjamin Peitzel. And it's noteworthy because Peitzel will later become part of Holmes's downfall. And he becomes kind of Holmes' accomplice in a lot of these frauds because he's got like five children. He is an habitual drinker. He never seems to have any money for the family. So he likes these schemes because they can make money off of them.
Yeah.
And so Holmes does these things. He killed another mistress too. Well, they assume he killed her. They never were found because he knew how to get rid of bodies because of his medical training.
So it wasn't just like medical training because he would be, you know, messed up things with a body, but because he's able to know what'll work to either get things smaller or disappear.
And there were some stories that one of the mistresses was actually later, her skeleton was later sold to a doctor, and that's how they identified it because I think he did that only two or three times where he would strip the body and then sell the skeleton. He was always trying to make a buck.
Yeah,
that's for sure. How he kept all these things in it without anybody ever finding out is, I don't want to say amazing, because that sounds kind of like admirable, but it's not admirable at all. But it's, you almost go, geez, well, how did he do all that?
If you think about how some serial killers are caught, the smell alone of, you know, a corpse is enough of a giveaway for the most part, or at least to have a suspicion. But I guess because he owns the building, it could always be like, oh, another tenant.
And the murder, it came to be, first they called it the castle because of how big the building was. Well, after this, it became the murder castle. And now we're finding that a lot of the stories were exaggerated by the press, who sort of kept these things going, which we learned in Jack the Ripper, which we talked about in the Penny Dreadful episode.
Yep.
A lot of 19th century things we've talked about, the media played a part in a lot of this. In fact, after all this was discovered in the 1890s, before Holmes was, I'm kind of giving the story away, before Holmes was executed, the Joseph Pulitzer's World newspaper had like this whole layout, floor plan, if you will, of his castle. It was all fictional. They were just, now that doesn't, I'm not trying to get Holmes off the hook, but in this particular case, which the thing he's most known for has kind of been exaggerated. I mean, some people have claimed he's killed 200 people, and most people say, no, no. But what happens is in 1894, he's passing through St. Louis, and he gets caught for trying to sell stolen goods.
Of course.
So he's briefly jailed. Someone bails him out. It's never clear who does. This guy travels so much, it's, he must have had frequent train miles or whatever they had in those days. But so he meets an outlaw named Marion Hedgepeth. And for some reason, he starts babbling on about this plan he has to fake his own death and then collect money from the insurance company. So he asks his Hedgepeth, well, do you know a crooked lawyer? Well, I don't think he used the word crooked. That's the word I used. Who could help him with this scheme? And Hedgepeth says, yeah, I do know one here in St. Louis that could help you. And Holmes says, great, I'll cut you in for $500 commission. Okay, so far, so good.
Right. Okay.
So the plan fails because Holmes, he tries to press a claim. Well, Holmes or whoever, whatever alias he was using. And the insurance company got suspicious. So Holmes didn't press it anymore. He just kind of backed off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it won't work now, but I have another idea. So he goes back, he finds Benjamin Peitzel, and he says, why don't you fake your death, and then you and I and this crooked lawyer will split the money. Okay, so far. He says, what I'll do is I'll get a cadaver, because remember, he knew how to do that.
Yep.
He knew how to do, and he knew how to sort of get them so they looked a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'll get a cadaver, and we'll say it's you, because, of course, there wasn't a lot of forensics then.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll collect the money. And Peitzel's like, had to convince his wife, and his wife went along with it, and she'll play a role later, too. And so everyone's like, okay, we're totally on board with this.
I like how there's just this group of five at this point that are just all agreeing for insurance
fraud. And then I'm thinking
to
myself, there's children in here, too, and they'll play a role in this story, too.
Oh, dear.
Yes, and not a good one. So one thing that Holmes is really good at was convincing people to do things. I mean, he just had this something that people believed him.
He had a charm to him.
Yes, very much so. And so, you know, I think of Ted Bundy too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Holmes gets Peitzel to move to Philadelphia because it's the Philadelphia Fidelity Life Insurance Company they're going to defraud. He said, well, okay, we'll set you up as an inventor. Call yourself B.F. Perry. And you're also like a patent office, you know, you can deal with patents. And what we'll do is we'll have you killed in an explosion. It won't be you. I'll put a cadaver in there. They'll think it's you. We'll come identify you, the cadaver, and we'll all split this money and be great. So on September 4th, I think 1894, Holmes goes to see Peitzel, and I don't know what happened, but Holmes must have thought, you know, instead of getting a cadaver and going through all that stuff, I'll just kill Peitzel.
So he's
because it's a genuine corpse.
Uh-huh.
And so he smothers him with chloroform, and then he burns his body with benzene, which I didn't know you could do. Of course, remember, he worked in a drugstore, so he's familiar with all these chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he tells Mrs. Peitzel, Carrie, that Benjamin Peitzel is in London, you know, because he had to leave the country because he faked his death. He's really dead.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So that wife is now told that he's not here. He's gone, but he's actually dead.
Right. And so Holmes and Peitzel's 13-year-old daughter, Alice, go to identify. Now, he didn't want Carrie to identify him, which tells me that he was afraid she would see it was really Peitzel.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the daughter, he just said when they went to identify the body that the wife was ill and couldn't come.
Okay.
And so he probably wanted the daughter because he was probably afraid that the wife might see something that she'd recognize and go, oh, no, that's him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what Holmes did is he cleverly covered the face because he said, oh, the disfigurement, I don't want you to be, you know, traumatized by all this. So I'll cover a lot of this. So you saw his teeth, and she, and I think Alice, I mean, she was only 13. I mean, she was probably frightened out of her head.
Yeah, you could tell her whatever at that
point. And she would have said, yeah, that's him, mm-hmm. you know. And, of course, the coroner said, okay, you know, so the insurance company pays out the 10 grand. But now Holmes and everyone's got to sort of go on they're not really going on the lam, I guess, is that's kind of the wrong word, but he sends everyone on this trip. And then he convinces Mrs. Peitzel to give him custody of three of her children. Because what he's, and I've never figured out why this was, but he says, I'll take three of the children, you take the other two, and then we'll kind of travel around so we won't get, so they won't find us, you know, if something happens.
Oh no, okay.
So he's running this parallel thing where you have him with these three children and their mother and other children, but they're not having any contact with each other.
It's getting more and more complex.
It's very complex. And it's kind of interesting how it all falls apart because he's got it going. And it's kind of heartbreaking too because the 13-year-old keeps writing letters to her mother who she gives to Holmes. And Holmes is supposed to send them to her, but Holmes keeps them.
And
he just keeps telling Mrs. Peitzel, oh, the children are fine. I sent them to live with a relative of mine. They're safe. I think it's hard to know. I think at this point, maybe Mrs. Peitzel's very scared. So she's just kind of going along with it because she doesn't know exactly what. I think they're starting to sense something's totally wrong here.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, they make a stop in Detroit before they go into Canada because he did go into Canada for a little bit. And they were only a few blocks from each other, and they never knew. And she never knew her children were that close to her.
They never passed each other. No signs of,
no.
Wait, I see someone familiar, nothing.
And you read these letters because for some inexplicable reason, Holmes kept the letters that the girl wrote. You know, she's almost like begging, well, why don't I never hear from you when she's writing to her mother? I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking, you know? And so this is going on and on and on. Well, a few months later, Marion Hedgepeth, remember him?
Oh, yep.
He says, you know, that guy never paid me my $500.
Oh, no, the 500, is that going to do it?
Yep.
Oh, no.
It kind of reminds you of that proverb, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, because it's like this little thing that Holmes, who was so meticulous, blabbed to this guy and promised him $500 and never paid him. Of course, I think he used a different name with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how a lot of these things got known, because the money was paid out. It was split up. In fact, Mrs. Peitzel wrote a very nice letter to the insurance company, who then used it for promotional purposes. So no one's really sure how this Hedgepeth got wind that maybe this happened and he got cut out. So he sends a note to this police chief of St. Louis saying, you know, when I was in the lockup, this guy was with me. His name was something, blah, blah, blah. And he outlined this plot to fake his own death. Okay, so somehow word gets the Philadelphia, but I think the Philadelphia insurance company was starting to get, they were starting to get a little suspicious too. Also because the children were missing.
Yeah, they would imagine there'd be some follow-up by the insurance company, some, even if it was just condolences, something nice
right.
Like that.
So the insurance company hires Pinkerton detectives to start following the trail of Holmes. Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Police Department puts a detective named Frank Geyer on the case. So Geyer starts tracing Holmes' steps. And this is in October of 1894. So he starts tracing his steps, and he winds up in Toronto at a place where Holmes lived. And they're searching the house, and they go down in the cellar. And they're like, there was an odor in the cellar. So they start digging up the floor. And Geyer says, as we dug up, the more we dug, the worse the odor got.
Yep, the smell, the odor, it's one of the hard things to
hide. Turns out Holmes had killed the two girls in October 25th of 18. They have the date because Holmes confessed, I think. And how he did it is, it's so bad that it's not really graphic, but it's how he did it. He convinced them to get into a trunk, which he then had drilled a hole in the top, and he ran a hose from the gas main into the box.
Mm-hmm.
And you can probably guess what happened.
So basically, they suffocated.
They asphyxiated. Yes. So he buries their bodies, and now why he murdered them? He already had murdered one child, the 5-year-old of his mistress. Mm-hmm. Now, some claim that the mistress died from a botched abortion. Now, remember, Holmes was a doctor. He could have tried it, I suppose.
Yeah.
That doesn't really mitigate the fact that he also killed her daughter. So then Geyer's like, okay, well, I wonder where else Holmes was. Well, Holmes actually went to Indianapolis then. Or actually, it was Indianapolis first, but I think Geyer was going in the opposite direction. So they get to Indianapolis, and then they find out Holmes was there, and then he had rented this house.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, hmm. Well, it turns out Holmes killed the 7-year-old Howard Peitzel in Indianapolis.
So all three kids that he got,
all three kids he murdered. And now Peitzel's, the husband's dead too.
Mm-hmm.
So now in this case, it was different. I think he killed him with some kind of drugs. And then he tried to get rid of the body by cutting up. And then, because later they found like teeth and bones in the chimney flue, which tells me he's trying to burn the body.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got this story getting out. So meanwhile, this story gets out and people are like, huh, maybe we should have a look at that building he was in. Now, they don't really find much. There's a lot of stories about, you know, this dissecting table and stuff, which people aren't really sure. But they find a few things, like the remains of a child, which we could have been the 5-year-old who was murdered. So they do find a few things, but the murder house story kind of takes hold. And that's what we know Holmes for. But I thought this Peitzel thing was really the linchpin that sort of brought him down. I thought it was more an interesting story, actually, in some ways.
Because, it starts with, oh, I've got this plot to get this 10 grand.
Right, which I wrote down today would be worth $368,246.
So that is not a small amount to change.
No, and apparently this crooked lawyer is still in on it because he's going to get a cut, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jedpeth Howe was his name. There are all these names, you know, you're trying to keep straight. So the Pinkertons follow Holmes to Boston, and that's where they arrest him.
Okay.
But what they realize is, can't really prove murder right now. But luckily, he had an outstanding warrant for horse theft in Texas.
Horse theft?
So they were like, hold him on that, because we're afraid if we let him go, he's going to flee the country, which he would have done, trust me.
Uh-huh.
So they held him on the warrant for horse theft.
Of all the things.
Of all the things. It's like Al Capone being tripped up by tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those little things. And I know some people might say, well, Scott, how is this historical? It's really true crime. Well, it's historical true crime, but it really shows you these little things that can happen that can unravel these huge things.
Yeah.
And then I think he starts confessing, but then he confesses to like 20 murders, which he didn't do. So no one's quite sure. A lot of researchers say probably 10 at the most. It's fairly certain he killed half of the Peitzel family.
Yeah, which, I mean, was the, aside from business reasons, monetary, was there never any some reason for any of this? It just
seems like when people got, either were too aware of what he was doing or he wanted something, like in the case of the plot in Texas, he had no compunction about, well, what's the best way? I mean, with Peitzel, I can just imagine him sitting there going, well, why go all that trouble getting cadaver when he's right here? I mean, he just had no conscience about any.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're killing children, I mean, really, what kind of conscience are you going to have? Really?
Yeah.
And so for years, Holmes has been famous for his murder castle, but I found the Peitzel story to be something you don't know about him, but it's the thing that got him.
Yeah.
And it was just basically an insurance fraud. And the irony of all this is that they were trying to get him for insurance fraud, but technically he never committed insurance fraud because he had a genuine corpse.
Yep, that's the thing. I was thinking about that because they actually had the body. It was really just to trick the wife at that point.
Right. So Holmes, Holmes admits to killing, he starts admitting it. And then he tries to say, well, I'm possessed by Satan and all these other crazy things. But it's interesting because sort of a side note to this, we're not very far from Lake County, Illinois. Here in Kenosha. And actually, he admitted that he killed two people in Lake County. And everyone thought, well, we don't have any bodies. Well, in 1919, they found two bodies, which was like 25 years after Holmes had been executed, or so. I probably have the math wrong. But they did find two bodies on a farm in Lake County, and they think he was two of their victims. And now it's like, well, we really don't know how many victims he had because people just disappeared, and there's nothing left to really trace that with the three children. You had remains that you had. So, but they're only able to prosecute him for one murder, the Peitzel murder.
Wow.
Because that they knew he did, and they could prove he did it in Philadelphia. And so I think he's brought back to Philadelphia. He is found guilty of Peitzel's murder, and he's hanged in 1896. And thus ends the life of H.H. Holmes. And he sort of, everyone calls him America's Jack the Ripper. But he never really used any of the things that we learned about Jack the Ripper. He didn't use, that wasn't his M.O. He didn't use any of those things.
And lastly, he was caught.
Yes.
And
people trying to say, well, you know, he went to England. There's this, someone, you know, cryptically wrote Holmes on some manifesto, and it's a time, but none of it matches because Holmes had killed people he knew.
Yeah.
The Ripper was killing, you know, street workers and sex workers. And so I don't think there's much of a connection there. I think but the fact they happen so close together is what I think fascinates people, that you had this part in the late 19th century where suddenly you had these two serial killers. But remember, Jack the Ripper only struck a few times, then he disappeared from the scene. Whereas Holmes, I don't know what he would have kept doing if he wouldn't have been caught.
And it seems like the method is very different.
Very different.
So to conflate the two as may potentially one doesn't seem to fit.
Right. And you have people saying, well, when he was young, his father was abusive, he was an alcoholic, and then he was bullied. I thought, again, I don't like... Yes, maybe he was all those things. That doesn't sort of get him off the hook for these things.
Absolutely.
Clearly,
not.
He knew what the hell he was doing when he was killing people. He wasn't like doing it in some kind of frenzy, whereas Jack the Ripper appeared to be doing it in some kind of frenzy as it went on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that Holmes is no Ripper, and it all came to an end when he was hung, and that's sort of the end of his story. And there it sat for years until I read Devil in the White City and realized there was a guy named H.H. Holmes that was once considered, you know, America's most notorious killer.
So what happened with the wife in the end? Because she still has two kids. I'm very curious where that story went.
Well, the wife was arrested, too, because she was part of the fraud.
Okay.
Now, she had no idea of the murders. In fact, she at this time, she still didn't know the whereabouts of her children or her husband. She kept thinking her husband was on, you know, waiting for her somewhere, which wasn't the case. When she found out, of course, it was hard news. And when she testified in court, it was hard for everybody. In fact, they said, you know, the jury was crying, the people in the gallery were crying. And I think the Philadelphia police thought, you know, I think she suffered enough. She had no idea of the murders.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she was involved in the fraud, so I think they kind of let her off with, you know, probably a light penalty for the fraud. Yeah. I think the insurance company's like, you know, if we keep pressing this, it's not going to look very good. So we'll just let it go. You got the guy. And I don't know what ever happened to the money, though. And you know, that's a good question. I don't know what happened to her after. There's not a lot of... They said that, you know, she did testify. And one thing Holmes did in his trial, he was so manipulative. So he noticed this, that everyone was crying, and that Mrs. Peitzel was getting this emotional response. So the next day, one of Holmes' wives came to testify. So he starts crying because he's figuring, I better get in on this. I better start looking sympathetic, because if I just sit here stone-faced, people are going to think it's worse than, you know. None of it worked, though. In fact, he was convicted so fast, the jury waited to announce their verdict because they thought it would be unseemly, I'm using air quotes, if they did it too quickly. That's how much evidence they had against him for all this.
I'm sure they had no sympathy points either.
No.
Wow. I did not expect that. Interesting. So comparing Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes and where they are and what's been going on with them. It's a great way to start our season. And I'm wondering, Scott, where are we going next time?
Well, I figured I'd probably milk this serial killer thing for a little while. I mean, I think these two were enough. I only think because these two fit into a certain pattern, you know. So I think next time, though, I was going to discuss code breaking during World War II.
Ooh.
Kind of a subject that's close to my heart.
All right, then we'll look forward to that. Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.